Hello and welcome back to the second part of the Hear This module on medicines in dental care, featuring Dr. Geraldine Moses, the consultant pharmacist to the Australian Dental Association. This part of the discussion focuses on adults and older people. Okay, well, that's a good discussion then about kids, but let's talk a little bit about adults. And I think that, like you were talking about before, not a lot of children get to see a dentist, and adults are probably just as bad, maybe for different reasons, no time, too scared, but still, you know, it is a difficulty potentially in terms of the cost. So quite often they'll just suffer it out with their dental pain and come into the pharmacy and ask you what they can do. So what sort of advice would we be giving adults with dental pain?
Well, if I could just quickly say, I think the government scheme that we have had for children to get to the dentist has been an amazingly useful thing, and it's a shame to see it go. But let's hope there'll be a new scheme that includes not just children but adults as well to subsidise their visits to government oral health clinics.
Yeah.
They are very widespread, by the way. And again, they're sort of a bit secret, and pharmacists often don't know that they exist.
Right. There's
a huge network of dentists working for the government, which means that people can go there for free dental care, but the waiting list could be up to 2 years. Nonetheless, you know, it is an option. So with adults, you're absolutely right. It's sometimes fear that keeps people away. I met a man recently who told me he had he just doesn't go to the dentist because he had a terrible experience when he was young. He had 38 teeth removed when he was 12. That's actually more teeth than we've actually got. I don't know how he did it. Methinks there's some exaggeration in the story. So I think people need to understand dentists are well aware that people are anxious about going to the dentist. And in my experience, because they know that people are often frightened about going, they're really nice people.
Sure.
And one reason why I'm really enjoying working with them, because I haven't met a dentist yet that I didn't like. That may still come. You never know.
Yeah.
But so far, they're extremely equipped for managing this sort of situation. Perhaps people have heard about the process of conscious sedation. Have you heard about that? Twilight sedation?
Oh, okay, sure, yeah.
So dentists can now get a 2-year certified qualification in administering either oral or intravenous sedation to help people relax in the chair.
Yeah.
It's usually benzodiazepines that give. But, like, just relaxing a bit can be all that you have to do. They've also got some special equipment, earphones and special glasses, and play music and put on movies, all sorts of things to distract you from what's going on.
So you can still communicate with the dentist even while you're having the extraction happening, but you're just a bit more relaxed. And I think with the benzo dose, basically you just forget what's happened to you, don't you?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
They'll with IV sedation, they will actually juggle the dosing administration to make sure that you do maintain a level of consciousness that you can continue to communicate. If you go any lower than that, you could stop breathing.
Sure.
And they also apply a pulse oximeter on your finger so that they can monitor how well your blood is oxygenated so that you're not reducing your ability to breathe as well. Mm. They do not want you to fall asleep or lose consciousness in any way. So The thing is that prevention is the best way, isn't it, with looking after any part of your body, let alone your teeth. And I think we don't think about this very often, but just good dentition and having no pain with your teeth and good function with your teeth is very more intricately entwined with our quality of life because we eat all the time.
Yeah.
And even if there's just one teeny-weeny thing wrong with your teeth, like a filling that's not quite right, it can annoy you all day, can't it?
Yes.
And the crunching feeling. So they're minor things, but they can blow up out of proportion because your teeth are so integral to your daily life.
So if we do get to the stage of dental pain, what should we be recommending?
Well, first thing I'd say, get an appropriate diagnosis. Again, this is like any other area of medicine, isn't it? The best form of treatment is an adequate diagnosis.
Yeah.
Now, dentists get really cranky about people getting antibiotics as their first intervention or even pain relief.
Okay.
Because for a lot of really serious things like an abscess or a cracked tooth or even a tooth that has to come out, the dental intervention is the most appropriate. And especially infections, that you might need to drain the abscess.
Mm.
And if you just take antibiotics, you're perpetuating the infection. And unnecessarily using antibiotics. And you could get that person out of pain and treat the infection with a dental intervention in one day as opposed to a week of antibiotics.
Sure.
Yeah, so always go to the dentist first and get an adequate diagnosis. And I think we do need to speak with our pharmacy colleagues about appropriate use of antibiotics, because what's happened with the dental profession is they learn pharmacology in their undergraduate course, but thereafter they're kind of thrown in the deep end. They don't have an internship year like we do. As soon as you graduate, you're out there on your own.
Okay.
So they tend to just sort of cling on to dear life, yeah, to the things they learned at university and to what's in the therapeutic guidelines. There's a tendency to just use amoxicillin, metronidazole, mm-hmm, or clindamycin. They're in love with clindamycin.
Okay.
And that's all they think exists. So they really need help from a friendly pharmacist to sort of know what all the different types of antibiotics are and how they're best used. I had a question just today about how do you administer clindamycin to children because there's no liquid dosage form. And the dentist just thought she could make up her own, okay, formulation. She said, I just told them to put 15 capsules into a glass of water, mix it up with water and keep it for the next 5 days.
Oh, gosh.
So they need our help in all kinds of ways. Another area where antibiotics are used in dentistry is for prophylaxis,
yeah,
for infective endocarditis.
Sure.
Have you come across that?
Yeah, sure. That's actually quite a risk for people who have already got a cardiovascular condition.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the olden days, they, yeah, used to give that pretty much to anyone who's, sure, having an invasive dental procedure or anything that went below the gums.
Yeah.
They believed that the bacteremia that was caused by going below the gums, having a bit of a bleed, would then cause bacteria to go systemic and it was all the dentist's fault. We now know that you probably get a bacteremia every time you clean your teeth.
Ah, okay.
So there's less risk seen as with a dental procedure, but it just so happens that strep viridans, that particular bacterium, is more likely to be associated with cases of endocarditis, either the acute form or the subacute form. And they kind of go, well, that strep viridans mostly comes from the mouth. Can also come from the ear, nose and throat, by the way, mm-hmm, so we really shouldn't be pointing our finger at the dentist all the time.
Mm.
So they feel that this is an area where they have to do their best to prevent the spread of this bacterium from the mouth to the heart in particular. So they give that whopping great big dose of amoxicillin 1 hour before the procedure. But I get asked questions of things like, what if the patient says they're allergic to amoxicillin? Well, we, yeah, now know that heaps of people are wrong when they say they're allergic. Yeah. So it's working through that claimed allergy.
Yeah.
Secondly, could they tolerate cefalexin? Because they probably could. So working through who would be a reasonable candidate, and that would be people who don't have an immediate type hypersensitivity reaction.
Sure, yeah.
The type 4 allergic reactions, which are not IgE mediated. In other words, the daggy rash that breaks, yeah, out a couple of days down the track, that's the sort of allergy where we know can tolerate cephalosporins quite happily.
Sure.
You don't need to use clindamycin.
Yeah.
Whereas in the past, the practice has been if they can't take amoxicillin, you've got to use clindamycin. Now, clindamycin's expensive, comes in packs of 24. You don't want to have to just take 4 and then what are you going to do with the rest of the packet? It's a drug that's got great efficacy and a great spectrum. We'd like to keep it special,
mm,
and not have heaps of people using it when they don't really need to. And then there's this issue of you can't swallow capsules and you've got to put it in a teacup.
Right, exactly.
You can do that for one single dose, as long as you take that dose immediately, that, yeah, it won't keep the fire.
You can't hang on to it, yeah.
Yeah. So this whole prophylaxis thing is huge. And then there's surgical prophylaxis, just the whole thing of which patients are at risk of even systemic infection from a big surgical procedure in your mouth.
Mm.
And so maybe pharmacists who work in hospitals might be more involved with this sort of decision-making. But the whole antimicrobial stewardship then gets called into question about, are we really using these drugs appropriately? And I'd have to say the therapeutic guidelines have a special edition called Oral and Dental. Have you ever looked at it?
Yeah, yeah, I've seen it, yeah.
It's fantastic.
Okay.
So I'd encourage all our pharmacy colleagues to have that,
mm,
have access to that. I mean, if they get it electronically, they'll just get it as part of their subscription.
Sure, yeah.
But if you only get the little books, yeah, then make sure you have this book too, because it has everything in there you could want to know about dental use of antibiotics, that's for sure.
Well, that would also be really handy for pain management.
Yes.
I mean, I've been in this situation, especially in day and night pharmacy, where you get someone coming on a Sunday night after having had dental surgery on the Friday morning, and they say they gave me this little packet of painkillers. They're well and truly gone by now, and they've still sort of got a little bit of bleeding potentially in their mouth, and you think, well, what can I give them?
Mm, yeah, good point. In general, all pain inflicted from a dental operation is inflammatory in nature.
Right.
So the ideal analgesic is an anti-inflammatory.
Mm-hmm.
So generally speaking, ibuprofen is the drug of choice.
Yeah.
And that's simply because across the board, with all the risks that we talk about, it seems to be the easiest to use. It's got low GI risk, some cardiovascular risk, but it's not huge.
Yeah.
In 3 days dosing, up to 3 days dosing of up to 1,200 milligrams a day, there's no increased risk of GI bleeding, perforations and ulcerations. It doesn't seriously interact with too many other drugs, and it's extremely efficacious.
Yeah.
Then there's this new data of combining it with paracetamol.
Yeah.
And in the doses used, they are give excellent efficacy, especially for, it's great, the studies have been done in dental extractions, mostly of extraction of wisdom teeth.
That's actually quite a good model for dental pain studies, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. It is, as a model for any kind of pain.
Yeah.
Yeah. That it's been shown to be as good as either drug combined with codeine.
Yeah.
Or even better and last longer.
Yeah.
So I think that's just substantiating the fact that you really only need an anti-inflammatory. You don't need a narcotic.
Sure.
But if there's a neuropathic element to your pain or even an overlay of anxiety and fretting on top of the pain often causes hyperalgesia, you know, it starts to get hypersensitized to the pain, then the patient might need some codeine or indeed something like doxylamine from Mercindol as the relaxant to help them feel like the pain is being addressed and they can calm down and sleep.
Okay.
Sleep's another thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
If the person had the operation and didn't sleep well that night, the next morning they're not only poorly slept, but in a lot more pain.
Yeah, it's really stressful.
Yeah. So I guess we have to look at the whole situation, and that's what I'm also trying to teach the dentists, because they do have a bit of a convention of saying Panadine Forte for everybody.
Yeah.
To try and tailor the analgesic to the patient.
So you mentioned that obviously nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories are beneficial, but some people who are listening might be a bit worried about giving something like ibuprofen to someone who's just had dental surgery because of the bleeding risk.
I'd like to reassure our listeners and you, Brett.
Yes.
That this isn't actually that much of a risk.
Yeah.
There have been studies done that implied there might be a risk, but it was all based on tonsillectomy. And tonsils are a very vascular tissue. So they do bleed, and very spectacularly, if there isn't good hemostasis after the operation, but there has been an association with people using NSAIDs as their analgesia post-op to increase the risk of bleeding. But for dental surgery, it's not the case, and the reason is it's less vascular tissue.
Okay.
I think it's just our lack of experience. We haven't gone and watched wisdom teeth removal.
Right, yeah.
But because I'm mixing with so many specialist areas of dentistry, all the different areas are telling me that the first thing I have to educate doctors about is that people don't bleed as much from extractions and manipulations of the oral mucosa and the bone as much as you'd think. So people think there's going to be a lot of bleeding. There just isn't. And a good example of that would be with the new oral anticoagulants.
Yep.
We actually, the guidelines say to leave people on the NOACs.
Yeah.
Even if they're having extractions, even if they're having multiple extractions.
Right.
So if we're going to let people stay on an anticoagulant and have a tooth pulled or many teeth pulled, then what's the problem with taking a little drug that might have an effect on their platelets? Yeah, and it's really not borne out experience either, because it is very common to use ibuprofen as post-op analgesia. If they were having problems with bleeding post-op, I think somebody would have studied that by now. Well, they have studied it and haven't really identified that as a problem. I suppose we need to always circumscribe that with that would only be if you took it for a short period of time.
Sure, yeah.
Like we always say with NSAIDs, probably up to 3 days before you would say, we need to look at this now.
Yeah.
But in that first 3 days, generally speaking, we don't see an increase in bleeding. If there is an increase in bleeding, it's probably from something else.
Okay.
Like the person might have an undiagnosed coagulopathy, that, you know, factor IV Leiden deficiency or something they never knew they had.
Yeah.
Maybe they took 67 aspirins and didn't tell anyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe they drank green tea. There are other reasons why people might be anticoagulated. But even patients on NOACs do not have troublesome bleeding after an extraction. And the dentists have a lot of tools in their toolbox for promoting hemostasis in the socket after they've taken a tooth out, including things like, if they see a bit of extra bleeding, they'll put in a few stitches.
Sure.
And tranexamic acid. So our old friend tranexamic acid, I'd like to be able to talk about this if we could.
Sure.
The guidelines recommend that dentists now have access to tranexamic acid mouthwash in their surgeries, practices, for extraction, post-extraction management of bleeding. And yet there's no ready-made product, is there?
No.
So I get about 25,000 questions on this.
Okay.
Yeah. Because they go, where do I get this from? Who's got it? How do I buy? How do I order it?
Yeah.
I frequently get people writing prescriptions for a fake patient and, you know, saying, is it on the PBS? And they go, why is it on the PBS? And is compounding a real thing? So it's a bit tricky.
Are you aware that compounders are making it? Or
yeah, they are. Everybody's making it. You're doing it pretty easy.
Yeah.
And also what the guidelines recommend is just getting the tablets you can get and just squashing them up, crushing them, mixing them with a bit of water and swishing that around your mouth.
Yeah.
So anyone can do that.
Mm.
I recommend for people who have manual dexterity problems like the elderly that they get the mouthwash made up.
Sure.
But it's quite expensive.
Yeah, I imagine.
It can be up to $70, $80 for 200 mils. They might need that much.
Yeah.
So there's one of the compounding companies makes a gel, and that's a really clever idea. But, of course, that hasn't really been subjected to a lot of testing.
Mm.
And then there's hospital pharmacies do make available just the right amount of powder in a 200 mil bottle. And then they provide that to the practices and then they can add the water when they need it. That way they don't have to get it dispensed straight away. But I am encouraging the dentists to, what they used to do before I joined the ADA as their advisor, was they'd get the tablets for their practice, have a bottle of 100 tablets sitting on the shelf, which they would crush up with two spoons and use post-procedure. And then they'd get a plastic Ziploc bag, throw a few tablets in, get a Nikko pen, write the instructions on the pen. Ziploc bag and send the patient home with that. Patients frequently would go tablets and swallow them.
Oh, right, gosh.
And, you know,
yeah.
And the problem, of course, is that's all illegal because it's an S4 drug. It should be appropriately packaged and labeled. So ideally we'd like a proper manufactured preparation for dentists to use, especially since the guidelines kind of mandate that they should be using it. And that's because there was a death. There was a patient on warfarin who had an extraction performed in Western Australia. This is in 2014. And she was not sent home with tranexamic acid mouthwash to use after the extraction. But also she was not given any written instructions. She was an elderly lady.
Yeah.
And basically she bled and bled and bled and bled out.
Okay.
When they found her, there was blood everywhere. The coroner did an investigation, but one of the recommendations from that investigation was that all dentists must give tranexamic acid to patients who are on oral anticoagulants who have extractions. And now they go, where am I going to get it from?
Sure. So, I mean, it's kind of complex, but obviously pharmacists can help with advising them if they get any inquiries about it.
Yes. And can I say one other sneaky thing is that in Queensland, where you and I are right now, we have the process of the health professional using a purchase order, a document called a purchase order, to obtain S4 medicines for their practice, right? Right,
sure.
That's all spelled out in the legislation. But lots of other states in Australia don't have that spelled out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why people go, what do I do? Do I make up a patient? Do I say I'm the patient even though I'm the dentist? So I would like to encourage pharmacists elsewhere to know the role of a purchase order, a document called a purchase order, and to help their dentist know that that's how they can acquire drugs for their practice.
Okay.
And if they're not sure, then ring their local state health department about how that should be done. But I have done that and they've all said, oh, purchase order is a good idea.
Hmm.
They just put it in their legislation.
Yeah, they don't exist quite everywhere. So you mentioned before about the issue with the older lady and once upon a time, it was inevitable almost that you would go to the dentist once you reached a certain age and have all your teeth out and be fitted with dentures. And obviously pharmacy used to cater for that because we stock various denture adhesives and pads and everything, et cetera. But is that still the case? Are dentures inevitable for all of us?
Definitely not. Dentures are going out of fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so we now have a generation who are living longer, but also keeping their teeth for longer.
Okay.
So the dental profession is having to educate for the first time on dental care of aged care patients. They really don't know a whole lot about it.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, they haven't paid a lot of attention to the role of medications in the elderly either. I've been giving a lot of lectures on this topic, but I do need my colleagues to back me up on this, please. Yeah. Because when they take a medication history, I don't know, have you been to the dentist lately, Brett?
Oh, not for anything spectacular, no.
But when you go, do they give you that form to fill in?
Every once in a while. I think you've got to redo it then in 3 years' time or something.
And they ask
like
you about every disease you could have ever possibly had.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then there might be like a tiny postage stamp size thing that says, write your medications here.
Yeah.
It's teeny tiny.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous, isn't it? So we know how important a comprehensive medication history is. In general, most dental practices aren't doing that.
Okay.
And if anything, they just say, what medicines are you on? And you might write down the three that you think are most important and leave the other 12 out.
Yeah.
So the first thing about dental care of aged care patients is educating them on the importance of getting a comprehensive medication history that includes not just their prescription medicines and blah, blah, we all know this, but even their puffers for their COPD and complementary medicines. So that's an area. And also that aging really does affect the mouth. There are certain pathological conditions that increase in frequency in older patients in the mouth. And, of course, the big thing that's changing is the procedure of implants. The people now don't get dentures. They might lose their teeth, but then they just get teeth put back in.
Sure, yeah.
And they're cemented in with titanium posts into the bone. There's a whole process called osseointegration where you wait for that titanium to be incorporated into bone. And this is where the whole osteonecrosis thing fits in.
Yeah.
Will that bone respond to the post? Will it wrap around the post and keep it in? And there's various medications that can contribute to failure of that implant to take. So there are dentists who are trained in putting in implants when they attend a weekend course.
Okay.
So it's a tricky area.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly there are very, very highly trained professionals who do it. The periodontists mostly do it as a specialty, but a general dentist can do it as well. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
I'd like it if pharmacists knew more about that process and that the interaction between the medicines that people are on and care of the oral cavity of a person who's older and having these procedures.
So you mentioned osteonecrosis before. I think it's probably a good opportunity for us to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 2003, there were a number of case reports about osteonecrosis of the jaw, or ONJ.
Mm-hmm.
And can you tell us what that is, ONJ?
ONJ is a complex condition that involves atrophy of the bone. The bone starts to die. The blood vessel supply of the bone shrinks, and it's also more prone to infection. So it will, if there's a lesion there, it won't heal, and it will just increase in its the significance of it and also the size. It's interesting, isn't it, that when I did a literature review when I was first starting to write lectures on the role of medications in ONJ, the term osteonecrosis was only associated with continuous use of corticosteroids and it affecting the hip, you know, osteonecrosis of the hip.
Sure, yeah.
People used to get it when they had a thing called Perthes disease, and that was all weird. Osteonecrosis of the hip, full stop.
Yeah.
But since the 21st century, this has all been about bisphosphonates.
Sure.
Yeah, so those first cases that you mentioned in 2003, after bisphosphonates have been on the market for over 10 years, shows how long it takes to learn about long-term effects of drugs, hey.
But they were in specific patient population?
Not anymore.
Oh, okay, right.
Back then I think they thought they were awfully clever that they'd worked that out. They went, oh, it's only cancer patients. Oh, it's only people who've had amino bisphosphonates. And we're going, what's an amino bisphosphonate? Or intravenously administered. But I think that was a detection bias because oncology patients are more likely to be in touch with their medical team, and if they're attending a public hospital especially, they may even have a dental service in the hospital that's seeing them all the time because they've got other things that go wrong with their mouth and they're having cancer treatment, you know, like mucositis and so on. So I think the fact that those were identified in cancer patients made everyone think it only happened in cancer patients.
Right.
Very quickly subsequent to that, though, with bisphosphonates being the main treatment for osteoporosis, it has been identified that it is going to happen with doses used in osteoporosis as well. And now, of course, we've got a range of 4, 5, 6 even new classes of drugs that are also linked with causing ONJ. So it's gone way beyond bisphosphonates.
Mm-hmm.
The first one will be denosumab,
yeah,
brand name Xgeva when it's used in oncology patients, and Prolia for osteoporosis. And there's now a contraindication, brand new, advised by the TGA just last week, that Xgeva, the cancer doses of denosumab should not be administered if the patient has an unhealed dental or oral lesion or a surgical site. And so that's new. And so that could be an implant, you know, or maybe you had veneers put on your teeth just last week, and that they can do some cutting and things of the oral mucosa.
Sure, yeah.
Of that. But implants more likely. You might have had a cracked tooth, they remove the tooth and stick in the implant, and then next week you go, oh, I got breast cancer.
Right.
And they might want to start giving you denosumab. You've got to wait until that implant's healed before they can start that now.
Okay.
And with the osteoporosis dose, there are plenty of cases, and there's even a case of a lady who had only had one dose of denosumab, and she was she had an oral, she had an extraction.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it didn't heal, and she'd only ever had one dose. So there are other things that couldn't cause ONJ. But the other drugs now linked with ONJ are bevacizumab, which is Avastin,
mm-hmm.
which is used for a range of cancers, and it's the action of it inhibiting vascular endothelial growth factor, or mm-hmm. VEGF for short, so anti-VEGF drugs, including the NIBs, so that sunitinib and sorafenib have got
yep.
good data on them. And any of the drugs related to them. So the ADA in the United States have put out a position paper on this, as well as the American Association for Oral Maxillofacial Surgeons, about there being all these new drugs associated with ONJ. And then there's drugs used for transplantation. And I can't remember. Sorafenib, I think, is the one that's used for post-transplant,
mm-hmm.
maintaining the immune suppression. And then thalidomide and lenalidomide also being associated with cases. And then adjunctive treatments like corticosteroids, if you've been on, say, a course of prednisone and you've had some denosumab, that has a synergistic effect of increasing your risk of ONJ.
Okay, so that's the licit for causes of ONJ. But we do know that illicit drugs can affect your teeth. Can you fill us in there a little bit about that?
Yes, well, all of the stimulants, amphetamines in particular, and cocaine are associated with strong anticholinergic side effects and adrenergic side effects, which dry up your saliva production and change the content of your the contents of your saliva.
Yeah.
So lead to dry mouth, and that dry mouth can be so severe that it then allows bacteria to overgrow. Plus, these people are often consuming sweet drinks.
Sure.
And then also smoking, usually.
Yeah.
So it's this triple whammy on your poor teeth, that the enamel breaks down and they get terrible caries. And they don't do anything about the caries because they don't care, or, you know, they're not really paying a lot of attention to their oral hygiene. And then the teeth just fall out. So it is awful. And you can see also an increased risk in oral cancers, because of the exposure to extreme dry mouth and the carcinogens from smoking.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's dry mouth also from just normal prescription drugs too, isn't there?
Yeah.
And this is something we have to educate our dental colleagues on, that they have been taught at university that polypharmacy causes dry mouth. So because they don't know enough about drugs, they just go, lots of drugs, and they don't really care what they are.
Okay.
Whereas you and I and our friends will know which kinds of drugs are more likely to do that. We've talked about the illicit drugs, but the pharmacology of those drugs is the same as many prescription drugs that also lead to dry mouth. You may have come across some calculating anticholinergic burden.
Yeah.
You know, that can be a surrogate measure for saying that if there's a high anticholinergic burden, that's also going to be a high indicator of potential for dry mouth. And it can be weird drugs you wouldn't think would cause dry mouth, like sedatives. All the Z drugs, for example, and benzos all cause dry mouth.
Yeah.
Narcotic analgesics that you might be using therapeutically. So somebody on long-term opiates for chronic pain management is at risk of dry mouth. Yes, they can be abused as well and be seen in an illicit environment.
Mm.
But if used prescription-wise, they also cause dry mouth. Antidepressants, all the SSRIs, SNRIs, all cause dry mouth, and beta blockers. I love beta blockers. I think they're very handy, and I know lots of people who use them for performance anxiety. My sister takes some propranolol. She's an ophthalmologist.
Yep.
And she performs microsurgery.
Oh, okay, yeah, sure, wow.
And she takes a 20 milligram dose of propranolol before she operates. Every now and then, she said she forgets if she's taken it or not, so she goes, right. She's got a dry mouth, she knows she's taken it. So because we've got such a broad view of drugs and their pharmacological effects, we can, you know, advise people on dry mouth issues from the legitimate medicines to the illegitimate medicines.
Well, look, there's so much to think about, and obviously, as you mentioned, because the dentists are now starting to see people in an older age group, which they wouldn't necessarily have seen before, they're going to have a lot more inquiries for us about these things that I might not have thought about before in terms of drug use as well as adverse reactions in the mouth.
Mm.
So thanks again, Geraldine.
You're welcome. We've covered a lot of area, and thank you very much for inviting me.
For the purposes of pharmacist CPD credits, by listening to this module, you can claim one Group 1 credit. For those pharmacists who are members of the college and would like to undergo an assessment to be eligible for Group 2 CPD credits, they can proceed to the college website, www.acp.edu.au, and enrol in the activity called Hear This, AJP Audio, Medicines in Dental Care. I'm Dr. Brett McFarlane, Education and Research Manager for the Australian College of Pharmacy, and thank you for listening.